Monster from the Deep. February 2nd, 1894. The Caribbean Sea. No one on board the old wooden-hulled warship Kearsarge could have foreseen the catastrophe that was about to strike. Displaying the flag and protecting United States interests in the West Indies, she was on a voyage from Haiti to Nicaragua when her lookouts spotted a strange shape in the water a mile off the starboard bow. Visibility under clear skies stretched to the surrounding horizons, and the sea was calm, the swells rising no more than 2 feet from trough to crest. The black, humped back of a strange species of sea monster could clearly be seen with the naked eye. "What do you make of it?" Captain Lee Hunt asked his first officer, Lieutenant James Ellis, as he stared through a pair of brass binoculars. Ellis squinted through a telescope braced against the railing to keep it steady at the object in the distance. "My first guess is that it's a whale, but I've never seen one move so steadily through the water without showing its tail or diving beneath the surface. Also, there's a strange mound protruding forward of its center."
"It must be some type of rare sea serpent," said Hunt.
"No beast I'm aware of," murmured Ellis in awe. "I can't believe it's a man-made vessel." Hunt was a thin man with graying hair. His leathery face and deep-set brown eyes were those of a man who spent many long hours in the sun and wind. He clutched a pipe between his lips that was very seldom lit. Hunt was a Navy professional with a quarter century of ocean-going experience and a fine record of efficient conduct behind him. He had been given command of the most famous ship in the Navy as an honor before his retirement. Too young to have served in the Civil War, Hunt graduated from the Naval Academy in 1869 and served on 8 different warships, rising through the ranks until he was offered command of the Kearsarge. The venerable ship had earned her fame after an epic sea battle 30 years earlier, in which she'd battered and sunk the infamous Confederate raider Alabama off Cherbourg, France. Though evenly matched, Kearsarge had reduced Alabama to a foundering wreck in less than an hour after the start of the battle. Her captain and crew were feted as heroes by a grateful Union after their return to home port. In later years, she had served on cruises around the world. With a length of 198 feet, a beam of 33 feet, and a 15-foot draft, her 2 engines and 1 screw could propel her through the water at 11 knots. Her guns had been replaced 10 years after the war with a newer battery, consisting of 2 11-inch smooth bores, 4 9-inch smooth bores, and 2 20-pound rifled barrels. She carried a crew of 160 men. Ancient though she was, she still packed a powerful punch. Ellis put down the telescope and turned to Hunt.
"Shall we investigate, sir?"
Hunt nodded. "Order a 10-degree turn to starboard. Request Chief Engineer Gribble to increase our speed to full, turn out the crew for Gun Station 2, and double the lookouts. I don't want to lose sight of that monster, whatever it is."
"Aye, sir."
Ellis, a tall, balding man with an expansive, neatly trimmed beard, carried out his orders, and soon the time-honored ship began to increase her speed, the waves splitting her bow with sheets of foam as she swung against the wind. A plume of heavy black smoke poured from her funnel along with a spray of sparks. The decks of the old warhorse trembled with anticipation as she took up the chase. Soon the Kearsarge began to close with the strange object that neither increased nor decreased its speed. A gun crew assembled, rammed a power charge and a projectile down the barrel of a 20-pound rifled gun and stood back. The gunnery officer stared up at Hunt, who stood next to the helmsman.
Number 2 gun loaded and ready to fire, sir."
"Put a shot 50 yards ahead of the monster's nose, Mr. Merriman," Hunt shouted through his megaphone.
Merriman simply acknowledged with a wave of one hand and nodded at the man standing next to the gun with the lanyard in his hand, and another man who was aiming the elevation screw on the breech.
"You heard the captain. Lay your shot 50 yards ahead of the beast."
The adjustment was made, the lanyard was pulled, the big gun roared and leaped back against the thick stay rope running through the eye ring on its butt. It was a near-perfect shot,
and the shell splashed directly in front of the giant hump that effortlessly slipped through the water. Animal or machine, it ignored the intrusion and maintained its speed and course without the slightest deviation.
"It doesn't appear impressed with our gunnery," Ellis said with a slight grin.
Hunt peered through his glasses.
"I judge her speed at 10 knots against our 12.
We should be alongside in another 10 minutes.
When we've closed to 300 yards, fire another shot. This time lay it within 30 yards.
All hands except the engine room crew were lining the rails now, gazing at the monster that was closer to the bow of the ship with every passing minute. There was only a ripple on the surface, but white froth could be seen swirling in its wake below. Then the mound on its back flashed and glinted.
"If I didn't know better," said Hunt, "I'd say the sun is reflecting off some kind of window or port."
"No sea monster has glass built into it," Ellis muttered.
The gun crew reloaded and fired another shot that struck with a great splash between 15 and 20 yards forward of the monster.
Still, no reaction.
It continued as if the Kearsarge was little more than a passing annoyance.
It was near enough now that Captain Hunt and his crew could make out a triangular housing atop the monster, with large, round quartz ports.
"She's a man-built vessel," gasped Hunt in amazement.
"I can't believe it's possible," Ellis said vaguely.
"Who could have built such an incredible contraption?"
"If not the United States, it has to be of British or German origin."
"Who can say? She flies no flag."
As they watched, the strange object slowly slid beneath the waves until it vanished from view. The Kearsarge passed directly over the spot where it sank, but the crew could detect no sign of it in the depths.
"She's gone, Captain," one of the seamen called to Hunt. "Keep a sharp eye out for it," Hunt shouted back. "Some of you men take to the rigging for a better view."
"What do we do if she reappears?" asked Ellis.
"If she won't heave to and identify herself, we'll pour a broadside into her."
The hours passed, and sunset came, as the Kearsarge cruised in ever-widening circles in a fading hope of finding the monster again. Captain Hunt was about to break off the pursuit when a lookout in the rigging shouted down to the deck.
"Monster off the port beam about 1,000 yards, heading our way!"
The officers and crew rushed to the port railing and stared out over the water. There was still enough light to see it clearly. It appeared to be coming directly toward the Kearsarge at a very rapid rate of speed. During the search, the gun crews had stood patiently, their great muzzle loaders primed and ready to fire. The gunners on the port side quickly ran out their guns and sighted on the approaching apparition.
"Allow for her speed and aim at that projection aft of her bow," Merriman instructed them.
Adjustments were made and the gun muzzles depressed as the monster loomed in the sights. Then Hunt yelled, "Fire!" 6 of the Kearsarge's 8 guns roared, their explosive blasts shattering the air as fire and smoke spouted from their muzzles. Staring through his binoculars, Hunt could see the shells from the 2 big 11-inch pivot guns smash the water on each side of the baffling thing. The 9-inch smooth bores added to the geysers erupting around the target. Then he saw the shell from the 20-pounder rifled gun strike the monster's back, bounce into the air, and ricochet across the water like a skipping stone.
"She's armored," he said, stunned.
"Our shot glanced off her hull without making a dent."
Unfazed, their nemesis aimed its bow unerringly amidships of the Kearsarge's hull, increasing its speed and gathering momentum for the blow. The gun crews frantically reloaded, but by the time they were ready for another broadside, the thing was too close and they could not depress their muzzles low enough to strike it. The detachment of Marines aboard the ship began firing their rifles at the assailant.
Several of the officers stood on the railing, grasping the rigging with one hand while firing their revolvers with the other. A typhoon of bullets merely glanced off the armored hull. Hunt and his crew stared in disbelief at the nightmare that was about to ram the ship. Transfixed by the long cigar-shaped vessel, he gripped the railing to brace himself for the inescapable collision. But the expected shock never came. All any of the crew felt was a slight shudder beneath decks. The impact seemed little different from a slight bump against a dock. The only sound was the faint crunch of shredding wood. In that frozen moment of time, the unearthly thing had slashed between the Kearsarge's great oak ribs as cleanly as a murderer's knife thrust, penetrating deep inside the hull just aft of the engine room. Hunt gaped in shock. He could see a face through the large transparent viewport on the pyramid-shaped housing on top of the underwater ram. The bearded face had what seemed to Hunt to be a sad and melancholy expression, as if the man inside felt remorse for the disaster his strange and bizarre vessel had caused. Then the mysterious vessel quickly backed off and fell away into the depths. Hunt knew the Kearsarge was doomed. Down below, seawater poured into the Kearsarge's aft cargo hold and galley. The gaping wound was almost a perfect concave hole through the hull planking 6 feet below the waterline. The torrent increased as the warship slowly began to list on her port side. The only thing that saved her from immediately foundering was the bulkheads. In keeping with naval regulations, Hunt had ordered them sealed as if the ship were going into battle. The inrush of water was contained, but only until the bulkheads gave way to the crush of tremendous pressure. Hunt swung around and stared at a low coral island not 2 miles away. He turned to the helmsman and shouted, "Steer for that reef off the starboard beam." Then he called down to the engine room for full speed. His main concern was for how long the bulkheads could hold back the flood of water from gushing into the engine room. While the boilers were still able to make steam, he just might have time to run his ship aground before she sank. Slowly, the bow came around as the ship picked up speed and set a course for shallow water. First Officer Ellis did not need a command from Hunt to prepare the boats and the captain's gig to be lowered. Except for the engine room gang, all crew members were assembled on deck. To a man, they focused their eyes on the low, barren coral reef that was nearing with agonizing slowness. The propeller thrashed the water as the boilers were fired by the stokers in a near frenzy. They shoveled coal with one eye on the open grate and the other aimed at the creaking bulkhead, all that stood between them and a horrible death. The single screw thrashed the water, driving the ship toward what everyone hoped was salvation. The helmsman called for help in fighting the wheel as the ship became sluggish with the escalating weight from the incoming flood and the list to port that had increased to 6 degrees. The crew stood at the boats, ready to board them and abandon ship at Hunt's expected command. They shifted uneasily as the deck sloped ominously beneath their feet. A leadsman was sent to the bow to throw out a lead weight and sound the bottom. He called out the depth in fathoms. 20 fathoms and rising, he yelled out with the barest trace of optimism. They needed another 100-foot rise in depth before the Kearsarge's keel would strike bottom. It seemed to Hunt that they were approaching that tiny strip of coral with the pace of a drunken snail. Kearsarge was settling deeper in the water with each passing minute. Her list was nearly 10 degrees, and it was becoming almost impossible to sustain a straight course. The reef was coming closer. They could see the waves striking the coral and bursting in a glistening spray under the sun. 5 fathoms, the leadsman called out, and rising fast. Hunt wasn't going to risk the lives of his crew. He was about to give the order to abandon ship when the Kearsarge drove onto the coral bottom, her keel and hull gouging a path through the reef until she came to an abrupt stop and rolled over until she rested on a list of 15 degrees.
"Praise the Lord, we're saved," murmured the helmsman, still gripping the spokes of the wheel, his face red from the effort, his arms numb with exhaustion.
"She's hard aground," Ellis said to Hunt. "The tide is ebbing, so the old girl won't be going anywhere."
"True," Hunt acknowledged sadly. "A pity if she can't be saved."
"Salvage tugs might pull her off the reef, providing the bottom isn't torn out of her."
"That damnable monster is responsible.
If there's a god, it will pay for this travesty."
"Maybe she has," Ellis said quietly. "She sank pretty fast after the collision. She must have damaged her bow and opened it to the sea."
"I can't help but wonder why she didn't simply heave to and explain her presence." Ellis stared thoughtfully over the turquoise Caribbean water.
"I seem to remember reading something once about one of our warships, the Abraham Lincoln, encountering a mysterious metal monster about 30 years ago. It tore her rudder off."
"Where was this?" asked Hunt.
"I believe it was the Sea of Japan, and at least four British warships have disappeared under mysterious circumstances over the past 20 years.
"The Navy Department will never believe what happened here," said Hunt, looking around his wrecked ship with growing anger. "I'll be lucky if I don't get court-martialed and drummed out of the service."
"You've got 160 witnesses who will back you up," Ellis assured him.
"No captain wishes to lose his ship, certainly not to some unidentifiable mechanical monstrosity."
He paused to look down into the sea, his mind turning to the job at hand.
"Start loading supplies into the boats. We'll move ashore and wait for rescue on firm ground."
"I've checked the charts, sir. It's called Roncador Reef."
"A sorry place, and a sorry end for such an illustrious ship," he said wistfully.
Ellis threw an informal salute and began directing the crew to shuttle food, canvas for tents, and personal belongings onto the low coral clay. Under the light of a half-moon, they labored all night and into the next day, setting up camp and cooking the first of their meals ashore.
Hunt was the last man to leave the Kearsarge. Just before he climbed down the ladder to a waiting boat, he paused to stare down into the restless water. He would take to his death the sight of the bearded man staring out of the black monster at him.
"Who are you?" he murmured under his breath. "Did you survive? And if so, who will be your next victim?"
In the next several years, until he died, whenever a report reached him of a warship that had vanished with all hands, Hunt could not help but wonder if the man in the monster was responsible. Kearsarge's officers and men existed without hardship ashore for 2 weeks before a trail of smoke was sighted on the horizon. Hunt sent out a boat with First Officer Ellis, who stopped a passing steamer that took Hunt and his men off the quay and carried them to Panama. Strangely, when Hunt and his crew returned to the United States, there was no board of inquiry, a very unusual circumstance. It was as if the Secretary of the Navy and the admirals wanted to sweep the incident quietly under the carpet. To Captain Hunt's surprise, he was elevated in rank to full captain before his honorable retirement. First Officer Ellis was also promoted and given command of the Navy's newest gunboat, Helena, and saw service during the Spanish-American War in Cuban waters. Congress authorized $45,000 to raise the Kearsarge from Roncador Reef and tow her home to a shipyard. But it was found that natives from nearby islands had set her on fire to salvage her brass, copper, and iron. Her guns were removed, and the salvagers returned to port, leaving her hulk to disintegrate in a coral tomb.